Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you all very much for coming. Not sure I need the microphone, but I will use the microphone. My name is Roger Collenbaugh, and I am a professor at the Columbus School of Law of the Catholic University of America, and thank you all for coming today. Our dean, Dean Vero Miles, is not yet here, but I did want to thank her. I know she will be coming. Not only for sponsoring this entire series, but for giving me the opportunity to put together today's program. And before I begin, I'm going to have some welcoming or introductory remarks to explain the basis for the program. Before I get into that, I want to introduce today's panel. And it is really a fantastic panel, so I'm really grateful for each of them for taking time out of their schedules to come today. I can't possibly do justice to all of their accomplishments, so I will just try to keep it brief, and I'll just go in the order that we're going to speak. But Professor Richard Schmalbeck is the Simpson, Thatcher, and Bartlett Professor at the Duke University Law School. He is formerly the Dean of the University of Illinois College of Law, co-author of one of the major federal tax case books. And his recent scholarly work, very interesting work, worth reading, is focused on nonprofit organizations and charities. Eugene Sterley is the Richard B. Fisher Chair and Institute Fellow at the Urban Institute. He was formerly the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Tax Analysis and an instrumental figure behind the shaping of the 1986 Tax Reform Act. He is a well-known speaker and author. He's written many, many books and articles, including a book called Nonprofits and Government. So he takes a great interest in the charitable sector. Diana Aviv is the president and CEO of the Independent Sector, which is a national leadership forum for many of the nation's charitable organizations. She is a strong, powerful, and eloquent voice on behalf of the charitable sector and has had great influence over the shaping of legislation. She testifies regularly on Capitol Hill and is featured regularly in major media outlets. And at the far end of the table is Mr. Russell Sullivan. He is currently the staff director of the Finance Committee of the United States Senate. In that capacity, he has great influence over the shape of the nation's tax laws. He's been with the committee, served under two different senators, Senator Max Baucus, and before that, Senator Pat Moynihan, and prior to that, served with Senator Bob Graham. He's often regarded as one of the most influential staffers on Capitol Hill and is known for his wit, energy, and strategic sense, as well as his smarts. So this is really a terrific panel, and I thank them for coming. My own background, before becoming a professor 2 years ago, I was on the Joint Committee on Taxation on Capitol Hill, so I approached this issue in part from a legislative focus point or viewpoint. And so I want to explain a bit what's behind the title of the panel. It says, Philanthropy in the 21st Century, Should All Charities Be Created Equal? Well, the title of the program is in a way intentionally provocative. It's designed to get us to think a little bit about whether we have a vision for philanthropy in the 21st century. If you look around, the turn of the century gives us human beings a time to reflect. And we are, I think, at a point of making critical choices in a lot of policy areas. It might be energy policy, it might be healthcare, it might be fiscal policy, tax policy. Many policies are facing these 21st century types of decisions. Well, I say, why not philanthropy as well? Why don't we think about philanthropy and the type of philanthropy we would like to see in the 21st century? Now, in order to get to 21st century philanthropy, whatever that might look like, and maybe it's the status quo, I like to take a step back and think about philanthropy in the 20th century to give us a sense for what we might be springboarding off of. And you'll have to forgive my oversimplified characterization of philanthropy in the 20th century, but I'm going to identify two characteristics, one of which is multiple benefits. So we started off under the federal income tax with a tax exemption. And sure, that made sense. You know, at the time, maybe the charitable sector was a little bit smaller. We kind of knew what a charity was. Why would we tax that charity's income if they had any? Let's let them keep it for good so that we aren't thwarting their operations. So we get an income tax exemption. And then, of course, we also get a deduction for charitable contributions. And there is access to tax-exempt financing. And on top of that, at the state and local level, there are exemptions for property tax, for sales taxes, for various user fees. There are also regulatory benefits to being a charity, and there are common law benefits to being a charity as well. So there are multiple benefits that become associated with the word charity. And the federal tax law definition is important to that. It's not the driver of it necessarily, but it is important to that. So we have multiple tax benefits, and I think we also can characterize 20th century philanthropy to a certain extent as one of pluralism. It's a pluralistic notion, namely, we will decide who is charitable in a fairly open-ended way. We will take a broad, purpose-based approach to charity. So it's kind of a big tent philosophy. The government is not going to make really substantive distinctions about which charity. I mean, we determine what is a charity, but within that, we don't make substantive distinctions preferring one charity to another. It's a fairly large tent. Now, pluralism has some great benefits, and one of the benefits I think we all agree on is that, to a certain extent, it keeps government out of charity. It says we don't want government necessarily to define what a charity is positively. We'd rather that the people decide through funding charities by donations or by consuming the services of charities. So there's a certain laissez-faire approach in the way we have approached charity. And this, I think, has helped us to form a very dynamic, a very diverse, and a very strong charitable sector. And that is a good thing. Now, it comes with it, I think, to a certain extent, there are some costs. One of the costs is that it has, to a certain, maybe diluted the meaning of charity. When charity is so broad and so many organizations can qualify, you lose some clarity. Combined with that, a large sector is also a sector that is somewhat difficult to oversee. And so what we've seen at the close of the 20th century is a large and growing charitable sector. So now we have over 1.2 million charitable organizations. They control over $3.2 trillion worth of assets, and in 2009 had revenues coming in of about $1.5 trillion. So it is a large sector. Now, the question then for me, taking this model into the 21st century, is what might we like about it? Actually, I'll have to ask a different question. Is the model showing signs of stress? And I think that it is. And that's partly what is driving the title of this program. There are signs of stress to our pluralistic approach. And you don't have to look very far. I think if you look at recent legislative trends, the recent reform legislation in the Pension Protection Act, to me, took a very significant step by taking a particular type of charity, namely credit counseling organizations, out of Section 501c3 of the code and giving them separate exemption standards. Now, what that says is that all charities are no longer going to be treated equally in the code for purposes of tax exemption. Now, at the time, there's a question, is that just credit counseling organizations we're talking about, or is it reflective of a trend? Well, we see a few weeks ago, the Congress passes in the healthcare legislation new exemption standards for hospitals. So hospitals, too, the largest part of the charitable sector, have been removed to a certain extent from Section 501c3 and given their own exemption standards. I think that is showing some signs of stress within the pluralist model, namely that distinctions are starting to be made with respect to charities. We also see it in recent oversight initiatives by the IRS, and one in particular strikes me as important, and that is the governance initiative. Governance is sometimes, it's now suggested, there's a link between governance and tax compliance. Well, to the extent you can collect the data and show that there is such a link, then the IRS has a new oversight tool, an oversight tool that it can use presumably to try and ensure tax compliance in the tax-exempt context. Well, what is tax compliance in the tax-exempt context? It is, to a certain extent, to make sure that charities are doing charity. And governance is a means toward that end. I think that the governance initiative is also another sign of stress. And there are others, whether it's the colleges and universities initiative or the hospital initiative or the mooted charitable spending initiative. I think there are other challenges to our pluralistic model of charity, and that is what we see today reflected in the economic downturn, which is partly the premise for today's panel. But the economic downturn puts additional stress on charity. I think if you read the paper very much, you know that charities are suffering. Some charities are folding. And it's, of course, because there are less revenues. There's less money coming in privately, and there's less money coming in publicly. So charities need more money, and this happens at the same time that there is increased demand for charitable services upon some charities. Now, this, in my view, is a moment of clarity for us, which is, which charities is it, or which charities are they, that we rely on in an economic downturn? Which ones do we look to provide fundamental services? Which ones do we want to succeed? And are those charities well served by the pluralist model, is a question. I think the economic downturn also, and this is more not necessarily just the downturn, but also is tied to government need for revenue, whether it's the downturn or whether it's deficits. But we also see now that government, too, is pinched at both the federal level and the state level. And so there was a headline in the New York Times about a month ago. It was quite alarming. It said, states rolling back property tax exemptions. So you read that and you might go into shock, which is, look, states are now looking for new sources of revenue. They might be looking to the income of charities. They might be revoking property tax exemptions or sales tax exemptions or imposing new user fees. Similarly, you could see on the state level, on the federal level, there the Obama administration has had a proposal about cutting back on the value of itemized deductions. So again, charity is viewed to a certain extent as a possible source of revenue. So there are stresses, in my view, on the pluralist model, and we're now looking forward to the 21st century and trying to decide, perhaps, what our vision should be. And I'll leave this with a final note, which is, even if you don't want to move away from the pluralist model and generally treating all charities equally, you want to work instead within the pluralist model to make it better, to serve our charities better, maybe to serve our people better. What things can we do to make the system work better? So if we look at our approach, we say, well, the subsidies are supposed to be facially neutral. We're not really trying to treat charities differently. It's a big tent. Is that actually what happens under our current system? Or are some charities preferred over others? So I want to start the panel there, which is looking at how the current subsidies actually work in practice. And what I thought I'd do was ask each panelist to introduce their remarks, and I'd sort of prompt them with a question. So the question for Rich, for Professor Schmalbach, so to speak, is, although the charitable subsidies may be facially neutral, are the benefits of the subsidies distributed equally, or do some charities do better than others?
Thank you, Roger, and thanks to Catholic University for arranging this and inviting me. Are they distributed neutrally and equitably? No. Let me go on. My work on this that Roger's familiar with and that led him to invite me to join this panel was begun for a conference sponsored by the National Center for Philanthropy and the Law, the Harvey Dales organization at NYU, which had a conference last October on the general subject of comparative worthiness. And I was kind of commissioned to write a paper about what it might look like if we tried to design a system that reflected, I think, a very widely held intuitive sense that not all charities are equal. And there are at least two important dimensions in which they're not equal or seem not to be equal. And one is simply the goals. You've got some charities that are operating to put nutritious food in the mouths of hungry children, and then you've got other charities where whatever subsidies they're able to receive seem primarily to operate to lower the price of an opera ticket so that even law firm associates who are making less than $200,000 a year can afford to go. And that doesn't seem particularly equally meritorious. And then you have a performance dimension. Some have strong governance, effective performance, efficiency, and others seem to lack that. Some seem to spend much of what they get raising the next, mounting the next campaign. Others seem to actually use what they get to deliver charitable goods and services. So we start out with this sense that, if we can perceive these differences, shouldn't we try to calibrate the system so that the subsidies go in the directions that we want them to go? The trouble, and I certainly share that intuitive sense, and the trouble with my paper was that I started out that way and then kind of lost faith. It's not that I don't believe that there are these distinctions. It's that I lack confidence in the ability of our political system to reflect those in ways that are going to be satisfactory. So I ended up thinking, before we start considering ways to consciously unlevel the playing field, maybe we should look at the playing field as it is now and note that there are there's almost a kind of hierarchy of charitable organizations in the system now, with some favored over others, but for reasons that are basically accidental and opaque and sometimes even perverse. So my paper was mostly about the ways in which the subsidies are not distributed neutrally under the current system and what we might be able to do about it. So I had to begin with the question of kind of what's the locus of the subsidy, where do we find the subsidies? And you hear mentioned a number of things, and it seems to me that the big one is the charitable contribution deduction. A lot of people talk about the exemption from taxes, and I would not want to say that there are no organizations that don't get a benefit out of being exempt, but we are talking about organizations that were designed from the ground up basically not to generate profits. And I think most of them don't, especially if you exclude from the revenue side gifts, which we ordinarily do exclude for income tax purposes. So if you take those out, what I think you find in the sector as a whole is there isn't a lot of profit there to tax. And if there isn't a lot of profit there to tax, then exempting them from a tax that wouldn't have much bite anyway, it does not operate to provide a great deal of subsidy. But the deduction's quite different. It's quite clear that we collect a lot less revenue from our taxpayers because of the charitable contributions deduction than we would if there were no such deduction. But the interesting thing about this is that when you think about it, the subsidy is not going exclusively to the charity. We subsidize the gifts, and the benefits of that are shared in some measure between the charity that receives the gift and the donor who makes the gift. And how much goes to whom depends on a number of things. And the one of the principal things it depends on is the tax elasticity of giving, how responsive people are to the incentives. And I've been on panels maybe four or five times with Gene Sterley in recent years, and I always have a mild sense of embarrassment when I hear phrases like tax elasticity of giving coming out of my mouth when I'm sitting next to Gene. It's like I'm pretending to be a public finance economist, and when you're doing that, you'd just as soon not be sitting next to one of the leading public finance economists who actually knows how all of this works way better than I do. I call him one of the finest public economists, public finance economists, in part because it's true, and in part because I'm hoping for a merciful treatment in his commentary, which follows. But the basic idea of this is if you imagine a kind of extreme case, and I think some of these cases are real. My understanding, although I'm not a Mormon, but my understanding on the basis of conversations with a number who are, is that they take tithing rather more seriously than most churches do. You really have to be tithing in order to be in good standing, and tithing is understood, apparently, although this is not completely free of doubt, but apparently is understood on a gross income basis. So if you make X, you need to give 0.1X to your church. Well, if that's the case, allowing you to deduct that is basically saving taxes for the donor, but not necessarily increasing contributions to the Mormon Church. It could still increase them somewhat, but it certainly may not have much impact on the amount of the donation. There are other situations, though, where it seems fairly clear that tax motivations are tremendously important in making the gifts, and I think probably the other polar case is someone who is giving a piece of appreciated art to an art museum. The tax benefits associated with that are huge, and I think that has a lot to do with the willingness of people to part with objects that they generally cherish in order to give them to a museum. Certainly the museums themselves believe that the tax features are critically important because they fight like tigers to hang on to them whenever there's any threat to them. So these things like the tax elasticity vary a lot, that in turn depends on things like the most obvious one is the marginal tax rate of the donor. A deduction is worth, generally speaking, 35 cents on the dollar to somebody who's in the 35% tax bracket. It's worth only 10 cents on the dollar to somebody who's in the 10% bracket. And, of course, it depends on being an itemizer in the first place. Something around 65-68% or so in recent years of taxpayers take a standard deduction. So they don't itemize their deductions, and they get no tax benefits from making charitable contributions. So when you put these things together and you kind of compare churches, let's say, with art museums, and what you find is that the structure of the system is one that seems likely to provide much more generous levels of subsidy to art museums than to churches. And maybe there's a good reason for that. I'm certainly not saying that that's necessarily bad public policy, but it is sort of accidental public policy. I don't think anybody actually, I don't think the Finance Committee and the Ways and Means Committee took testimony on this and decided that art museums needed a particularly great tax break and churches less so, but we sort of backed our way into that. So some of the things that I talk about in this paper. Certainly other features have to do with whether you feel compelled to support the organization, as in the case of the Mormon Church. That means that you're going to be making those contributions whether or not there's an incentive, and the incentives are by and large not going to produce much benefit to the organization. Depends on whether the organization is in a position to receive appreciated property gifts. And to some degree, organizations also get some kind of accidental benefits, at least I think they are largely accidental, based on particular factors that they make heavy or relatively light use of. For example, one of the non-federal benefits associated with charitable organizations has typically been a real estate tax exemption. That's important if you run something like a university that uses a lot of real estate. It's not important if you run a local Meals on Wheels operation that's operated out of the basement of a church. Some organizations make heavy use of mailing enjoy the benefits of significantly reduced postage rates, but others do not. So we have this kind of panoply of features and provisions in our tax law that operate to benefit some charities and not others, but not, it seems to me, on any very principled grounds. So I think I probably used up my 7 minutes, so I'll stop there and let others speak.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll move on to Gene. The question for Gene then was going to be, Richard has helped to describe a little bit how some of the subsidies are not necessarily equitable in fact. Some charities do better than others under the current approach. So I just wanted to ask Gene whether he thinks that our approach to distributing benefits to charity works well during an economic downturn or otherwise, and whether there are ways in which it could be improved.
Right. Like all questions and statements, one has to be very careful about how you juxtapose the words. I'm reminded of an ad in a church bulletin about attending a play, and it said that the play Hamlet will be put on in the church basement by our youth. Please come early to watch this tragedy unfold. So the way you ask the question is whether we do well in dealing with these charitable subsidies, if you want to, during a downturn. And I have to put that in perspective by the fact that, and I've said this also at the same conference that Richard referred to, was that if you think about it, government distinguishes among charities all the time, and it does it in the direct spending budget. And so when we start talking about the way government favors or doesn't favor charity with respect to the charitable deduction, we're talking about a fairly modest proportion of what government does. My own numbers, this was partly, I think, in one of the essays in the book, Nonprofits and Government, that Roger mentioned a minute ago. Social welfare spending in the United States is on the order of about 10 times what charitable deductions are. And if you count the charitable deduction as maybe, charitable giving is, and if you count the value of the tax subsidy within the charitable giving as maybe financing 20% of it, I'm not sure what the right number is, you basically come to the conclusion that the cost of the charitable deduction to the governments of the United States is about 2% of what they spend on social welfare. And the other 98% is still up for grabs. So when government responds in a downturn or to any other economic issue, it's usually going to look more at the 98 cents of, if you want to, or the 90 cents that they spend on directly. 8 cents is coming from the private individuals, another 2 cents is coming through the tax deduction. And I say that to just make it clear that we do distinguish all the time. You know, government does decide that we're going to fund Medicaid and Medicare. Even if we have, say, $300,000 or $400,000 a year surgeons, it's not going to finance, say, state and local education. The federal government doesn't finance much of the way state and local education, so it's not financing a lot of teachers out there at all. Food banks, it may or may indirectly subsidize through government subsidies, or it may not. And this is brought home to me another time recently. Mario Marino, who's well known in this local community as a real major philanthropist, who created a group called Venture Philanthropy Partners that actually tries to apply lessons from venture capital to venture philanthropy. He actually made a talk one time to a local group that I helped recruit for in Alexandria. And he said, well, you know, charities can do well until they get up to be something over $1 million. And once they start getting receipts and spending over $1 million, they basically start turning to the government because that's where the money was. And this is very interesting coming from him. I mean, he wasn't certainly a pro-government activist. He was just trying to make comments to charities on what they needed to do. So the way I'm putting all this together is that what I'm saying, the first answer to your question, Roger, is that government should respond to recession, but it's mainly got to look at the direct side of the budget. Now, there is a question as to whether charities themselves should be more counter-cyclical than pro-cyclical, using economic language. By counter-cyclical, I mean we would like charities, I believe, to respond the most when needs are greatest, and yet when we go into a recession, what typically happens is charities are hit the hardest, so they actually respond the least or respond less when needs are greatest? And are there ways that we could encourage charities to be more countercyclical? And are there ways we could affect government policy to get there? In the first case, I'm not quite sure, because I think that one reason the charities tend to be pro-cyclical, that is, they spend more when times are good and less when times are bad, is because we, the donors, sometimes demand that of them. And I don't mean that we just demand that of them in the sense that that's when we make our charitable gifts. But if these charities actually try to, build rainy day funds and create some asset value, in some cases we tend to say, oh, they got money in the bank. Obviously, we don't need to give as much to them. So we sometimes penalize them for operating in what I would believe would be a much more efficient manner in terms of dealing with the economic cycle. Now, for other charities, and actually we're hoping to have a session at the Urban Institute some point. People should tell me if they're interested. But with other charities, I think we could do more. I think the foundation sector is a case in point. Actually, the foundation sector has been less pro-cyclical than you might imagine. But simple formulas like you should give 5% of asset value to charity is sort of a silly formula without adjusting over the cycle. Now, there are some ways foundations can, Jan could speak better to this than I could, Jan Gallagher here from the Council on Foundations, could speak much better to the question of whether how foundations could adjust by setting aside money, calling it being spent, somewhere or another putting it in a fund that's technically spent but not dispersed, and other things like that. There are ways foundations can adjust for this cycle. I don't think they've done a very good job of it, and again, I don't think that we've created a formula that encourages them to do so, on top of which we have this little excise tax, which isn't big in the grand scheme of things. But for those of you who know the excise tax on foundations, it actually works in a very perverse way. If you actually give more than a certain percent of your assets away in a given year, you get measured in succeeding years as not doing as much, and so you can get penalized. So if foundations today are giving 8% of their asset value to charity because they've had a downturn, but they don't want to cut back on the charitable giving, the reward for doing this when their asset value goes up and maybe they cut back to 7, 6, or 5% is they could get hit with a higher excise tax. It's not a big tax, but it's just a silly little thing. And there are things like that I think we could fix. But maybe there are ways that we could go beyond a fix for foundations, but for other charities as well, in terms of encouraging them some or another to set aside these rainy day funds to meet these times, bad times when they come along. Of course, again, this isn't charities, this is state and local governments and a lot of other places as well. So I think we can do better there in a counter-cyclical way. And I just want to make one last comment, which goes a little bit more, Roger, to your question, or to Richard than to me. But and that's the question you talked in your initial comments. Let's see if I've got you. Call it the pluralist. I guess you call it the pluralist model in terms of the charitable deduction. Given that we have so much money coming from government, where government does decide how to spend it, it doesn't bother me greatly to have a pluralist model for this small amount of money that the government spends in terms of the cost of its charitable deduction, where it says, okay, in this particular case, we're going to back off a little. We're not going to be the ones that are going to determine how the money's spent. We're going to let you, the giver, decide. There's somewhat of an analogy, if you want to, with research. The government sponsors a lot of research directly, and then indirectly it provides a research and development tax credit that says, okay, well, whatever you, the industries, or the companies, or the private individuals decide are going to be researched, we'll give you a credit there, and you'll decide what the optimal research is. It seems to me that's not a bad mix. We can argue, and I agree with Richard. There's pieces of particularly when we get to things like postage subsidies and stuff like that are not evenly provided. But do we want to keep a pluralist model? I think it's a good idea. It's a good idea to have both systems, both where government decides directly what it wants to do, and indirectly where it creates a pluralist model that lets us, the givers, decide where the charitable deductions should be allocated. I don't know if that's really so much of a cyclical or counter-cyclical thing, but I think there's a case to have both models. I think, and even in the latter case, even if you have some question about whether it creates the perfect amount of giving, I certainly would give a lot more to charities that serve the poor. It does create an information system that would be hard, I think, to replicate otherwise. I sort of like it for that reason as well.
Well, and maybe I'll ask a follow-up on that, because one of the things that concerns me a little is, to the extent the government is cutting back on its direct funding of charities, so it's spending a lot less. So that 98 number that you cited is going down, say, to 80 or whatever, but they're spending a lot less. So what makes up for the shortfall, I suppose? If we rely on the government to spend the money to serve some critical needs, or to fund charities that serve critical needs, and then the government backs up, stops spending so much, then do we rely more on the pluralist model to kind of offset the decrease in government? No. Or should we, I think, is the question. I mean, should government try to offset some of their cuts in spending by doing something under the charitable deduction?
You know, in my ideal world, income would be a lot more equally distributed. People would give away a lot more, and therefore we'd be less dependent upon government to do these things that it doesn't always do well. But once we're in a world where government is a, say, operating social welfare budget at about 20% of GDP and charitable giving is about 2%, there's absolutely no way that charity is ever going to make up for even a modest decline in what government does. It just can't. You can't depend upon it to do it. The orders of magnitude are so different that there's no way charities can make up for it. But I also correct a little bit what you said, because government really isn't doing less in the social welfare function. What's happening, and we could have another talk on this if we want to talk about fiscal policy, but basically we have certain parts of the social welfare function that are also highly favored. You know, we're talking about parts of the charitable sector being highly favored. Those are basically health and retirement systems. Those are still growing topsy-turvy, particularly health. I mean, I could show you my graph on the extraordinary amount of increase in spending we plan on spending on Medicare and Medicaid, which is way in excess of the additional spending, by the way, in health reform that's already in the budget. And then an increase in Social Security, an increase in interest on the debt. And you know what? And after we take out the deficit reduction, you know what everything else has? Negative amounts. So we're scheduled to collect $1 trillion more in revenues in another 6 years. And over that $1 trillion, the rest of the budget is scheduled to go in absolute decline. So that's the squeeze in the charities you're thinking about. I think maybe it's the food banks or the charities that serve the poor really getting squeezed. It's not really necessarily in aggregate the hospitals are, this isn't even charities, are the people that are retired. They're not the ones that are getting squeezed in this. So government spending, social welfare spending, hasn't really gone down in the recession. It's just gone down in pockets that you probably care about.
Well, maybe that's a good lead in. It's a great lead in for Diana. And the question for Diana, who has a very close view to what's happening on the ground, is whether the economic downturn has exposed any weaknesses in our current system of incentives, and whether the incentives, in your view, meet the needs of civil society.
Roger, I'm going to answer that question, but I'm going to start with a test. And I'm going to ask you to consider the figure $22.6 billion. And ask you to think about whether that is the amount that the U.S. hotel industry earned in 2005. Is that the GDP of El Salvador, Cyprus, and Jordan? Or is that the amount that the federal estate tax generated in 2008?
Estate tax.
Well, if you said yes, Russ, to that one, you'd only be right partially. It's true for all three. And so, put another way, $22.6 billion is about half of what private foundations give away in 2008. And because Congress hasn't extended the estate tax this year, the sector stands to lose about 7% of total giving to charitable organizations. My point is that policy makes a big difference to our system of incentives to stimulate giving, not only because of the amount that the incentives stimulate in additional giving, but also because the kind of incentives change where the donations land. My colleagues have just said that. With that in mind, lawmakers allowed donations for the Haiti earthquake victims in January and February of 2010 to be deducted retroactively from 2009 taxes. The intent here, I believe, is to encourage people to direct their donations to this particular relief effort. However, if this temporary tax provision were to become law, one question it raises is whether people would dig deeper into their pockets to give more for disaster relief or would they reallocate dollars that they had planned to donate to other causes to take advantage of this particular tax benefit? On a one-time-only basis, in response to disasters, people tend to donate more money than they would otherwise already be giving. But that may not be the case if this option is available to them all the time. As you know, incentivized giving has long been a part of our national fabric. Over the years, however, the policies that shape our system, as Richard described, the system of incentives, has become a very loosely knit patchwork indeed. I think he described it in slightly sharper terms, but let me leave it at that. Some were created to encourage greater giving to particular causes, while others were enacted as the result of the advocacy efforts of various interest groups. I guess it's the way in which all policies get made. Together, our tax policies reflect neither a coherent point of view nor a set of priorities by lawmakers regarding which causes deserve more favorable tax treatment or whether lawmakers have responsibility to steer giving in particular directions. We know that some lawmakers have, for instance, lamented the fact that most foundation money goes to programs in our cities and less to rural areas. Others have expressed concern that tax-exempt dollars have not been adequately distributed to communities of color or those in need. From time to time, lawmakers have tried through legislative proposals to elevate one endeavor for favorable policy, regulatory, or tax treatment. The result, big surprise, has been strong opposition by the sector itself for a number of reasons. And among those reasons is the question of who should decide what constitutes a service worthy of special initiatives. If tax incentives, for example, favor donors interested in helping poor people, what kinds of services qualify for that special treatment? The university that undertakes research on pollution, that has the potential to clean up the communities often inhabited or nearby low-income neighborhoods? The museum that serves the entire community, even as it also gives special programs to benefit poor children? Do we then say that services that provide direct assistance, as in the form of food subsidies or those kinds of things, are the worthy ones, and that poor children are not entitled to arts and culture, exposure, and access? And what about those who argue that improving lives for an entire community also benefits its poorest, most vulnerable members? My broader point is that there is a significant challenge in setting the parameters for potential tax reform relative to treating some causes more favorably than others, and particularly that is seen by the public at large, who don't necessarily trust that their elected officials would come up with the right formula to decide what constitutes that kind of favorable treatment or what charities should benefit by that particular treatment. At the same time, having just said what I said, I'm about to contradict myself, existing policy that encourages giving has significant ramifications for where the money lands, as I began my comments. Consider the high net worth individuals, defined as those with incomes of over $200,000. It's not surprising that wealthy people tend to give the most relative to other groups, though not as a percentage of assets or incomes, but in sheer mass. Of note is that they tend to give less to health and welfare organizations and more to arts, culture, and higher education, usually their alma maters. According to the Center on Philanthropy in 2008, 21.6% gave to education and 11% gave to arts and culture. In contrast, they gave 7% to health services and 6.5% to basic needs. Their giving patterns raise interesting questions about whether government should even the playing field by incentivizing them or others to give more money to those who are at risk and in need, particularly during a recession. I think, Jean, though, your points are well taken, that it is such a small percentage of, in fact, what those organizations get, it's a real question of whether that would make a difference. The economic downturn exposed a number of soft spots or weaknesses in our current system of incentives that would have been revealed over time, I believe, anyway, which is, I think, what Roger's point is. I view them much like accelerants in a chemical reaction, No matter how many times we clean our cars, the combination of oxygen and water on steel causes our cars to rust over time. But if you live in a cold climate like, or cold state like Michigan or Maine, the salt sprinkled on the roads during snowstorms rusts the cars much quicker. The recession has exposed existing problems in our sector, I think, much faster. In this case, it is the fact that donors with the most resources and the ones most likely to take advantage of tax incentives tend to support causes other than our most vulnerable citizens at a time when state and local governments, on whom health and welfare organizations depend, are not meeting their commitments and contracts. Social and health service agencies typically get about 66% of their income from federal, state, and local governments, which is about $85.3 billion annually. 43 states have cut services because of funding shortfalls and cumulative state budget deficits, which are now approaching about $200 billion. Even as the economy shuffles ahead, the situation for frontline providers remains particularly acute because of delayed, eliminated, or eliminated state funding. A survey by the Nonprofit Finance Fund last month found that 58% of human service providers could not meet the demand last year, and that's because they simply didn't have the cash to provide it. Over 65% said that they probably would not be able to do so either in this year. So in sum, I think that these issues, though, are not just academic. As budgets get squeezed and lawmakers feel the pressure to meet their obligations, some may feel inclined to suggest that tax policy ought to be tilted to favor assistance to poor people. The President's proposal to limit what high net worth donors can deduct when making charitable donations may be, in fact, the beginning of a movement in that direction. Next might come deductions for different kinds of priorities. And while we may be a long way from enacting such changes, I don't think that they're out of the question.
Thank you, Diana. Maybe we'll move along now to Russ. The question for Russ was, should the tax law make more substantive distinctions among charities based on, for example, an organization's purpose? And what is your current thinking on any changes to the charitable deduction, either to foster additional charitable giving or to modify the scope of the subsidy?
Thank you, Roger. And let me say before I begin, not that it will make any difference to the people sitting in the front row, but the views I'm about to express are those of my own. They do not represent the views of Senator Baucus, the Finance Committee, the United States Senate, or the U.S. Congress. Nevertheless, here we go. I think we have made fairly clear today that there is a significant distinction on the value of a deduction based on the economic status of the donor. You have most Americans who get no tax benefit from their charitable donations. You have a group who itemizes who gets a value of the donation based upon their marginal tax rate. And then you have the most wealthy in our country who hit a cap and then they get no benefit above making contributions above that certain amount. However, more directly to your question on whether we should discriminate based upon the recipient, our current system really doesn't have a significant distinction currently. Now, Roger, you talked about us putting limitations on hospitals not be able to get a deduction for contribution to them if they don't post information about their policy towards indigents, and that was contained in our healthcare bill. There may be other things around the edges, but we really haven't done much in this category. At the Finance Committee, we have done several things that I think are generated by our members' desire to look into this issue and begin to do research. A couple of years ago, we asked some of our nation's largest institutions of higher education to provide us information about their endowments and how those endowments are used. And underlying that was the question of, should we really be providing this significant deduction for some individuals up to 35% if the money is going into an endowment for a university. And so we ask questions about where that endowment goes, how long it takes for it to get to benefit the scholarship of a student who's a poor economic background, those kinds of things. We've also looked at and had discussions with some of you out there about foundations and started to ask the question of whether we should give the same sort of benefit when the funds are going to take a long time to get to the ultimate charity and the beneficiary, since endowments foundations generally keep a lot of their money, and as we discussed, they have a minimum payout for each year. But we have not really gone that far in that direction, and going down that road gets very complicated very quickly. Not to say that Congress hasn't done that in other areas of the tax law, but there's been some resistance. I guess I do take Diana's note that we have a couple of times passed legislation encouraging donations to, I guess it's Haiti, and then we also did it in the tsunami in Asia a few years back. That could be the beginning of a trend where we try to encourage donations at a particular time. Certainly these have been sort of international downturns related to a catastrophe. Certainly we could look at that in the context of our own domestic economy and economic downturn. We could establish something like, in the business world, we have bonus depreciation, where we encourage companies during an economic downturn to make capital investments they might not already make by giving them a bigger write-off in the beginning and smaller write-offs in future years. We could do that in the context of charities in a downturn, incurring contributions to those dealing with the human needs side, and give them a double deduction or something like that for a certain period of time. I don't think we're anywhere near going down that road, but Diana is certainly right that we've maybe put our toe in the water there. I think the bigger issue related to the purpose of the institutions is going to play out not in the context of addressing legislation to reform the charitable sector per se, but in our analysis as we move forward and look at more broad-based tax reform. And in that context, I think we can and we will take a look at a much broader issue, and that has to do with the general tax treatment of nonprofit organizations. The history of our tax code is that we basically try to put all entities into one of two buckets. You're either a for-profit entity, in which we try to tax you as a corporation, partnership, or proprietorship, or otherwise, or you're a tax-exempt organization. You're a charity that we're not going to tax at all. Well, the reality is that every business really has multiple purposes. You could go down the list of virtually every corporation in America, and they make charitable contributions. That's part of what they want to do, is to support their community. And maybe you would say they're only doing that because it's good business for them. Maybe that's true in many cases. But we see the emergence of a lot more businesses who seem to have that as a principal purpose. I would point to, Microsoft or some other companies where their principal owners seem to want to set aside a large percentage of their profits for a philanthropic purpose. And the fact is also that charities also have some business purpose to them. That's why we established our unrelated business income tax regime. And we see more and more charities involved in disputes with the IRS regarding that. But I see even more blurring of the lines over the past decade, at least the time I've been in public service on Capitol Hill. We see the emergence, for example, of a lot of green energy companies. Now, maybe most of those are really aimed at profit motive. Profit is their main motive, but I think we see the emergence of some businesses where their purpose is actually to develop or promote a cleaner environment. They're just doing it through a corporate structure. Similarly, on the opposite end of the spectrum, we see missionaries today who go overseas and they set up a business. They set up a restaurant. They set up a school where they teach English. Now, are they doing that because they have a business motive? No, they're really not. They're doing it because that is a way for them to gain access to the people that they want to proselytize. But I use those examples just to say that we have a lot more blurring of the lines. And I think as we move forward in looking at our tax structure, we might see the emergence of some proposals to establish what I'll call, for lack of a better term, a for-benefit corporation. So it's something in between a private taxable company that's under our rules of C corporations or S corporations or partnerships, but also not under our rules of having to do with charities. And let me give you our most recent example where we face this issue, and that is in the health care reform bill. As most of you know, there are a lot of changes coming in health care. One of them is we authorize these state-based cooperatives to sell insurance within their states. Not a public option, not a pure private sector. And so the question is, well, what is the purpose of that entity, and how should it be taxed? Is it really sort of a government-owned entity that's part of the state government? Well, no, not really. Is it really private sector-driven and a corporation? Well, no, not really. It's really kind of in between. And certainly we have some rules in our tax laws regarding cooperatives. We've established those rules for agricultural cooperatives and others. But I think with the advent of some of the new kinds of business entities we're seeing evolve, that we're going to have to take a close look at that issue.
All right. Thank you, Russ. One quick question to follow up from that, and maybe something that Diana said, was both of you mentioned the temporary tax break for contributions to serve Haiti, and I know that we did that during the tsunami. And it also reminded me of after Katrina, there was a package of temporary giving incentives. And those were broader based. They weren't just, you know, that you could take up to April 15th to claim your charitable contribution deduction. So to what extent is or might that be a trend, not just with respect to disaster relief, but, you know, in light of an economic downturn, or could you design a package of tax incentives that were tailored to benefit charities in need or charities that have a high demand for services because of a downturn? Is that something, you know, to have those a temporary package? And is that something that is possible that you've thought about? Or?
Well, we are facing that issue even right now as we're looking at tax extenders and some of these issues of Katrina and some of the Midwest floods in the U.S. We actually have in our Senate bill some extension of those provisions passed the Senate in recent tax extension legislation. But we've actually moved more toward a model overall, establishing some common rules that would apply in any case of any disaster or certification of a disaster area, that the tax benefits are sort of automatic. And those are also, we've passed a year or two ago, and those are scheduled for extension as well. There is, you know, this has created some discussion on Capitol Hill as to whether we really want to get in the business of designing a package every time we have a different sort of specific need, whether that's an efficient way to do it or whether we should have something more generally applicable.
Roger, can I comment on that as well in a slightly different way than what Russ has said? Coming back to what Gene Sturley had said, if you were to ask among the largest charities in the country that provide health and welfare services to people who are at risk and in need, what is the single thing that Congress could do right now to help them? I don't think they would say enact tax incentives for charitable giving that will increase giving, because it's such a tiny percentage of their budget. They would probably say fix the Medicaid reimbursement rate, something like that, or they would say create a revolving loan fund so that when states that have defaulted on the contracts that they've made or states that are not giving contracts to these organizations to provide services right now, that there would be money that they could dip into right now so as to provide those services. I don't think they would see that as a solution for them. That doesn't mean that it's not a good thing or a good idea to do, but I don't think it would solve the problem in the short term.
Can I also just comment? I think none of you here know this, but for years I've been advocating that we actually allow charitable giving up to April 15th for all charities, which I think actually solves one of the major problems you raise, which is, and I think Diana mentioned it briefly, not this comment, but in a previous comment, is that if you just give an extra deduction for Haiti, it turns out that a good deal of that money may be nothing more than a substitution from some other charity. That is, the net incentive to give really isn't increased very much. The incentive just to shift your giving from one charity to another is quite substantial. Whereas if you do something across the board, it's operates quite differently. I should also say that one reason that I really like an April 15th deduction has nothing to do with the fact that there is any additional economic incentive. I mean, yeah, I guess for some giving, maybe if you don't adjust your withholding during the year or your estimated taxes, you'll get a deduction slightly quicker in the interest value of that deduction. But that's not the reason. The reason that I think allowing giving to April 15th would really work well is, and I've had a number of people respond to me this way, is it provides a tremendous opportunity for advertising. I mean, you know, when do you get a coupon to go to the grocery? It's not 8 months before you go to the grocery. It's sort of when you walk in the grocery store. Are they advertised as you walk in the door, you know, the items that are on sale? And so what I want to do is when people are sitting down and filling out their tax return, you know, that the TurboTax and the HR Block tax calculator basically says, oh, by the way, if you give another $100 to charity, by the way, we could reduce your bill by $30. And, oh, by the way, if you want to reduce, you want to avoid that penalty you have for being $2 over underestimating your taxes, you could just give a little to charity. And it doesn't really cost the system any more than it would otherwise for other charitable gifts. And the other nifty thing about it, if you care about it as an economist, incentives at the margins, if I'm wrong, you see, if I'm wrong, there's no cost. Because the additional cost to the government is when the giving goes up. So it's the perfect incentive. Every dollar of additional giving costs the government the 30 cents. But I'm not, unlike the normal charitable deduction, I'm not giving an extra deduction for giving that would take place otherwise. I don't want to get off too much into the sides of it. There's some administrative things that I would try to solve by basically trying to do other things that would, at the same time, perhaps only do this for charities that filed something like a tax form with the IRS so they could actually administratively match issues, which is another big issue with the Haiti deduction, is there's no way to monitor whether people are really doing it well. But I think there are a lot of things like this we could do to beef up the charitable deduction and make it more effective. You know, IRA deductions, oh, there's a whole bunch of things we could really, foundation, excess tax, there's a lot of things we could really work on well, but that doesn't mean that I disagree, that I'm, I also go back to where we are, Diana. The big money is not actually in the charitable giving for a lot of these charities. It's on the direct spending side of the budget.
And if I could just add something, I think we're all speaking to Russell about what you should do when you get back to your office. But I guess I would not particularly want to encourage Congress to try to be too responsive to particular disasters and things of that sort. Ellen April and I wrote an article a couple of years ago that looked at two very different kinds of disasters, the 9/11 and the Katrina response. And we were very troubled by the unevenness that those kinds of bills create. It's possible to find people who have suffered virtually identical kinds of losses but don't get special treatment. It's really, I think, hard to justify, for example, the relatively low background mileage deduction for the use of an automobile to provide charitable purposes, but then have a much more generous one for particular kinds of charitable work. It's usually a response to a sort of I'm sure I'll regret using this word, but there's something slightly sentimental or something about disasters that pull at your heartstrings right now, but they're kind of ongoing disasters that aren't maybe quite on the front page of the paper, but equally deserving, and somehow that latter group kind of loses out when Congress cherry-picks disasters that it wants to not particularly favor through different tax features.
Well, maybe I'll transition a little bit away from the charitable deduction to try and pick up on another theme, which is one of oversight. We've talked about trying to, the extent to which it's important to use the charitable deduction or not to favor certain charities, but I'd be interested to know the panel's view, whether they're concerned about the growth of the sector, that it has grown tremendously in recent years, and the law's ability or inability to keep up with the growth. That is, I mean, one of the themes, I think, in the past decade was, you heard this from Capitol Hill quite consistently, was what are we getting for the tax benefits? So that may be a rhetorical theme, but I think that as the sector grows, that question takes on more and more impetus, if not merit. And So is there a concern about oversight, you know, related to growth of the sector and in a sense, even the rules that we have that oversee the sector? You know, to what extent, even if IRS had all the resources in the world, would it have the legal standards it needed to enforce the rules and ensure that the organizations were doing charity? So I think, in short, the question is, are you concerned about oversight, and is there a need to provide for more of it, and what might that be? I don't know who wants to try and answer that, if anybody.
I'm willing to jump in again. And coming to two levels, I don't think there's a person at the table here. I won't force Andrew to speak for the senators, but who wouldn't argue that more resources to IRS to performance enforcement function wouldn't serve us very well. But I also know the incentives within that system. There's enormous pressure, first, to provide bang for buck, and most of the incentives to monitor the charitable sector in some ways are less revenue-raising or revenue-related than consumer-related. So the question is why the IRS should perform that function. And when push comes to shove, the revenue-raising functions tend to get emphasized, and the charitable group always tends to get the short end of the stick. And even if the revenue-raising functions aren't being monitored, then just trying to beef up and improve taxpayer service in general for, you know, 120 million, that's the number of individual taxpayers and others, is enormously important. And we actually don't audit businesses enough either. So there's a lot of competition for that money. One partial solution that I've been working on for many years is I became the godfather of a group that we started at the Urban Institute, which was called the Center on Nonprofits and Philanthropy. And what really got us started was we inherited the National Center on Charitable Statistics from Diana Aviv's organization, the Independent Sector. The National Center on Charitable Statistics is the group that worked for years and years on trying to get the 990 information out to the public. We were then joined by a partner, GuideStar, some of you may have heard of more often now, because it was able to raise a little more money, it's a little more visible. But together we've been pushing very hard on getting charitable returns available to the public, with the notion not simply that this allows us to sort of do research, which is sort of our own internal need at the Center of Nonprofits and Philanthropy, but more importantly, that if we can get this information to the public on a quick, very quick and timely basis, that this is the way the public really can do a much better job of monitoring the charitable sector itself. So if you want another version of the pluralistic model about engaging citizen participation, I think this is a great model. But we've always struggled even to get IRS to devote the tiny bit of effort that's necessary to, for instance, to get these returns available electronically. I think there's some one or two tiny legal issues too that are very minor, but that has prevented IRS from pushing further to get them electronically filed. And then even if they are filed, just even to get a few resources available so that we could actually put these returns out on a very, very timely basis. To me, this is a very, very cheap way the IRS can get us, the private sector, in some sense, to help them do the monitoring of the charitable sector that needs to take place.
Roger, just a quick question on a quick comment on the question of growth of the sector. Has it grown too large? What does that mean? We know it's grown at twice the rate of the business sector. It's doubled in size in the last 15 years, all those kinds of stats. We also know it's not sustainable. You look at the rate of growth of income from the various sources into the sector compared with the number of organizations, it's not even. And that was in good times. In bad times, Paul Light guesses, I don't know if Paul Light is correct or where he got his stats from, but he guesses that there will be next year 100,000 fewer nonprofit organizations than there were this year, simply because there isn't the money to sustain that. So some might argue a Darwinian perspective that let the market decide, and that those organizations that can't sustain themselves shouldn't be in existence. The problem with the growth question, when we put together the panel on the nonprofit sector for Senators Barkas and Grassley to offer some recommendations, we had big discussions about at what point can any entity, whether it's a government entity like the IRS or state oversight branches, since they're very different in the different states, at what point should they play a more vigorous role in determining whether an organization should deserve to exist? And many people felt that when organizations are initially created, that's not the point. It's really after viability of 5 years. And maybe at that point in time, we should take another look. The cost then for the oversight arms, whether it's at the state level or at the federal level, to then go through looking at every single organization to see whether they deserved to continue, whether they really served charitable purposes, would have been so burdensome, both from a financial and time point of view and altogether resource point of view, that wasn't viable. Then there were the group of people who said that the smaller charities, especially those in rural areas that are few and far between, where there's just one or two people working, would be the ones that would be the first to go as we shrunk the sector. And the larger entities that had the capacity to make the case for themselves would survive, and that in a structure in which government determined that there were too many or that kind of thing, that it would be the wrong ones that would go away. So we didn't figure out, we weren't smart enough, all the smart people who sat around our table, to figure out how to get there in a way in which the right ones would make it through and the wrong ones would go away, because of course the definition of what's right and wrong is so different. On the question of oversight, it's a very interesting question. When there's a lot of Sturm und Drang in the press about allegations of misconduct by some very well-known charity or less, everybody scratches their heads and says we need more oversight, and then we quickly look to see whether it's more oversight, more legislation, or whether it's better resources to enforce what exists. And then that seems to go away. Even if we were to double or triple the amount of money, we wouldn't get anywhere near the kind of percentages where the actual oversight itself would cause some kind of disincentive for bad actors to do to either get out of the sector or to do the right thing, which therefore means that in the end, I'm unfortunately, maybe this is cynical, but of the view that the IRS and state oversight agencies are going to be of limited value, that the press is probably one of the most important vehicles through which people do the right thing, to the extent that anybody is embarrassed by their bad deeds being put on the front pages. And I'm very concerned that if you look at what's happened to the investigative reporters in our press, there are fewer and fewer of them around, and that therein lies our biggest problem, because I don't think the government's going to be able to answer that particular problem.
Well, just a couple of thoughts about the oversight function. One of the looming problems, of course, is that primary oversight as to governance matters is actually with the state attorneys general, and the performance of that function is extremely uneven. You have some that are quite assiduous and well-staffed, and others that barely exist at all. The other is a problem that I think is particularly true at the IRS level, but it's also true to some degree of the state attorney generals, and that is that they are aimed at policing misconduct. But there's hardly anything about promoting good conduct, there's been talk about possibilities there, something like a Sarbanes-Oxley for nonprofits or something like that. I think if we want to do more than simply come in and occasionally say there's been private inurement here or self-dealing or excess benefits, we may have to think about something that's a little bit more focused on encouraging good performance rather than just discouraging egregiously bad performance.
Well, maybe this is a good time to open it up to the audience to see if the audience give you a moment to think and then see if any questions come up. Does anyone have any questions at the moment?
Can I ask Richard, just to follow up on your point immediately, what do you think of the governance initiatives by the IRS?
I guess I have mixed feelings about that, because I have felt there's kind of federalism issues involved here. There's a sense in which they're stepping out of their traditional role. On the other hand, states clearly aren't doing the job in any very comprehensive way. So I think there I have those kind of mixed feelings about it. I think in the long run, probably if the IRS doesn't do it, it won't get done in any very effective way. So I think it's probably a good step.
Yes, ma'am.
I haven't seen that much caution.
But the cautious ones are the ones you don't see.
There appear to be plenty who in my mind, move close to the edge. And it is difficult to draw that line between lobbying and providing information and that kind of thing. And it's a very difficult area of the law. And it's not an area where it's easy to craft a solution.
I think this is one where you sit is what you see. I imagine if you're a physician in an emergency room, you'll see a lot of broken people, and if you're not, you don't see that many. So you might see a lot of people lobbying, and you might see not as many as you think ought to doing that. I think from where I sit, with the foundations and nonprofits, the laws that were enacted are quite old. The limits on what's allowed should be revisited because there are limits that were relevant in 1969 that may not be relevant today. I think that there are people who, if there's an arc of what's allowed that's out so far, people tend to work within much less than that, and you might or some might want them to go all the way up to the edge. And then there's the question of whether foundations, the rules should change that would enable foundations as 501c3 charitable organizations to fund advocacy activities directly. Not that they can't get there anyway, witness what Russ has just said, but whether we should do that. There's an appetite among some foundations to do that, and there's a real fear by some foundations that if that gets opened up, that a whole host of other issues will be opened up now, so let well enough alone. I don't think there's a consensus in our community about how to move forward on that issue.
And I think there's several problems kind of under the surface here, but one of them relates to what Gene was saying about how much more potent government action is compared to philanthropic action. And so I'm sure that there are many organizations that sincerely and accurately think that the best way to achieve their objectives is to get the government to provide more assistance, and that leads directly to lobbying. But a concern that I have about that is that there is a problem with a system in which lobbying costs are generally not deductible. That is, I can petition the government for my grievances, but there's no line on the 1040 that allows me to deduct it. Businesses can't even take business expense deductions for lobbying for the most part. And so if the only organizations that can do lobbying on a tax-favored basis are charities that have received deductible contributions from people who have points of view that they want to advance, then I'm a little afraid that there could be a corrupting influence on the charities themselves as they become the favored mouthpieces of anybody who wants to lobby and also wants deductions. So I guess
I think there's a reason Diana says there's no consensus, and that is because I don't think any of us have figured out how to do this well. But by the same token, I don't think many of us think you should totally, for reasons Richard just stated, you should just drop the effort. That is, the question is, do you want charitable contributions to be able to go, say, for things like campaigns? Do you want charitable contributions to go for lobbying for your own very personal interest. And I would say probably most people, that's not what they think they want out of a charitable deduction. So once you say that and you try to stop it, it's a little bit like putting sandbags up to, you know, stop the flooding. You know, they work well in some places, and even when they work well, they just flow the water someplace else. So it's very hard to do well. On the other hand, you don't necessarily want to give up on the sandbags. I don't know any easy way to define sort of what's lobbying and what's not lobbying. And, you know, we have these lines. I mean, when I sat in a foundation for a year and a quarter just recently, you know, we had all these statements about, well, if we favor a particular bill, then that's lobbying. But if we go up and talk generally about the issue, then we're not. But then I see all sorts of my fellow think tank partners around town who definitely go up and lobby on bills quite directly. So, I'm not quite sure how to draw that line out very well either, except that I'm reluctant to give up on the charitable deduction still being mainly for charity and not to finance political campaigns and people's own interest.
Well, if I recall correctly, Russ, in the minority report, well, then it was the minority report after the Abramoff scandal, had a proposal about trying to cut back on the deduction for lobbying with respect to C3s that lobby. So that was something that has been mooted anyway. But Professor Simon, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you. I'm Carl Simon, also from the Catholic Law School. And I just wanted to raise a question for a couple of panelists, particularly from Russ. One of the things that is interesting to me, for those of you who know my work, you know, I'm principally the chair of Emeritus now. Why are we not looking at models from other countries? In other words, why are we not more carefully studying what England is doing with respect to both defining different kinds of organizations in between businesses and charities? Why are we not looking at the Charity Commission? Why are we not looking at what South Africa is doing with respect to defining what NPOs can do? I mean, it does strike me as a little narrow in the United States. We don't reach out and look at things that other countries do.
I have 7 staff members on my staff, and that's probably the answer to your question. Let me be a little more full. When we face a big issue, comprehensive issue like healthcare reform, we do regularly, almost exclusively, go out and do a thorough examination of other countries. We spent a lot of time in 2008 doing that in healthcare. Hosted a summit, and we compared Japan's system to England's system to other countries on healthcare. And it was very illuminating and helped us design the sort of fundamentals of healthcare reform. I suspect if we embark upon broad-based tax reform, we'll do the same thing. It is very difficult to do it, spend very much time on it, on targeted issues. And so we rely on people like you and others to do a little bit of that work for us and bring it to us when you see a good model. And that's really probably the best we can do, at least on Capitol Hill, with our limited resources.
Okay, yeah, Diana.
They could do it, but I think the pressure is the opposite way, at least from most of the senators, from my perspective. I think most of the senators, at least on our committee, have viewed the IRS as being an impediment and that the process was too slow in certifying 501c3 status. And that's why we actually pushed for a quicker approach, which the IRS actually has been doing lately. I think the view is that the benefits derived of expanding number of small charities does outweigh the risk of potential abuse, and that we ought to have focus on those abuses, but to spend a lot of time and effort when you're talking about a brand new charity whose budget may be $20,000 in their inaugural year, probably not. We probably need a lot of more of those formed in hopes that many of them will be successful in providing the services. And it should be at the larger organization level that we put more resources. think that would be the majority view.
I guess I wonder if they would have legislative authority to actually impose some kind of numerical limit. I don't like what could they cite to do that? I mean, I don't think Congress could help, but they could look more closely
at the proposed purpose, right, and whether it falls within the categories under 501c3.
I have a colleague who's just left independent sector but used to work at the New York State Attorney General's office, and his job was to have oversight over the new charities coming in. And he said that they spent a significant amount of time with organizations that they didn't think was viable, working with them to try and achieve viability. That kind of information is not what gets reported in the press, but there's a lot of that work that happens. It's usually the mistakes and the accidents and the problems around the edges that get reported. But they spent the vast majority of their time counseling organizations on helping them to do it right.
I think ours is so small, I think there's just limited amounts it could do. I mean, an interesting question for me, and I don't really know the answer to this, is are there some penalties that should be much heavier for the egregious abusers? The ones on the margin, I'm not sure, because we don't want people to be extra cautious just because they filed their 990 late or whatever. But you know, for these charities where some people are clearly using them to rake in money, I just wonder if the penalties ought to be a lot larger, and whether I don't know the answer to this question. So like Carla might be able to answer this better than I would, but or Roger for that matter, whether there are ways to expose them more readily as well. I don't know what the rules are that apply there or not. I'm really asking the question rather than answering it.
I've given a little thought to this. The IRS, there's that general felony provision about revealing return data, and it's my understanding that the IRS regards that as applicable to examinations of nonprofit organizations as well, even though I think it's not completely clear. But on the other hand, if a felony provision might or might not apply to you, you can understand how they would be conservative about thinking that it might. But given that the application for exemption is a public document and the 990 each year is a public document, I don't quite understand why the IRS takes the view that it can't disclose. And maybe Congress could help them out on this, actually, by clarifying the felony provisions about return disclosure. But just as an example, we had the audit program about campaign participation of churches that started in 2006, and All Saints Church in Pasadena kind of famously announced that they were a target. And the IRS made some general announcement like, yeah, we're looking at like 75 or 100 or something like that churches. But most of those churches did not choose to come forward. Which left the public just wondering, was this a vendetta? Were they targeting? I mean, All Saints was a sort of well left of center church. I don't believe that the IRS was targeting it by any means, but they feel like they can't describe the array and they certainly can't name the churches that were the targets of that kind of procedure. I think I just don't understand why this stuff should not be widely publicized, especially in an environment where the 990s and the 1023s are routinely, in fact, mandatorily available to the public.
I'm going to see if we have time for at least one more question. Yes, sir.
Creative say, you don't have a direct corollary of charity care the way hospitals. Hospitals can say, we give away this much in free care. Our property tax exemption was about this much. There's a direct corollary. We can say, we give this much away in scholarships and financial assistance and subsidies. This is our property tax exemption. Or even that kind of, like museums, you know, that they get into artistic value and so on and so forth. So just your thoughts about, I mean, that's the trend in many of us and what we're trying to do locally to determine our tax exemption.
I don't have a opinion about, I think, some of the bottom line questions you're asking, but I guess one of the things that is worth noting, at least, is that a problem for hospitals all along has been that 501c3 talks about educational, religious, scientific, et cetera, and there's nothing in there that actually says health or medical care. And so they've kind of had to get in through the charitable window, and they've been a little bit at the mercy of the IRS's willingness to consider hospitals charitable, and so they've looked at things like open emergency rooms and stuff like that. But I mean, a lot of those doctrines come simply from the lack of specificity in 501c3 about how you get to be tax exempt if you're a hospital. Museums, no problem, they're educational. So that's part of the historic background, I think, of the community benefit standard and why it's a sticking point for hospitals.
I'm not going to help answer your question. I'm going to say that actually you're just on the leading edge of what I think is just a growing issue. And Andrew alluded to it earlier when he talked about what they have to do in healthcare and started defining co-ops. Joe Cardozanaf from George Washington University put out a book called Nonprofits in Business. And one of the theses of the book was that this dividing line between nonprofits and business is becoming more and more amorphous over time. If you think about how we define nonprofits, it's generally sort of in two areas. One, well, we define them by the fact they don't have a profit function, but we all know that's pretty weak. You know, partnerships can give away all their money, or subchapter S, and we say, well, they don't have a profit, or, you know, it's all individual income. I mean, and we know a hospital can operate on behalf of the doctors and not on behalf of patients, so that doesn't tell us something. So another model we have is, well, let's define it by the things they do, like educational and informational and religious and so on and so forth. Well, it turns out, if you think about what are the largest growing sectors of the economy, right? They're in areas like education and health, which sort of classically fit in that charitable definition. And as those sectors of the economy keep getting bigger and bigger, absorb larger and larger shares of the economy, what does this breakdown of a nonprofit function like health and education mean versus a profit function? And don't even think about it just in terms of industries. Think about it in terms of you, the people sitting in this room. I mean, most of you have skills, unlike 100 years ago, that so readily transfer right directly from a profit-making organization to a nonprofit. I don't care whether you're in advertising or education or computers or anything else. So the definitions are really breaking down in all sorts of interesting ways. Where it hits the YMCA, now I guess we don't have time to go into this in particular, is you're on that part of the definition that tends to be more on the redistributive function. At least that's the terminology I would use, rather than the one that might be called sometimes associational, although you might appeal, we're also this association, we create a community place to meet. And so sometimes we want to measure for you or hospitals, well, okay, you're claiming to be charitable in the sense that you're doing more in sort of a redistributional way, that you're not just serving in your case, a high-class gymnasium attenders. In the case of hospitals, you're not just serving, you know, the general public. And even for the hospitals, it's tough, because if the public sector says in order to just operate in your area, you've got to take a certain number of indigent people, you can't prove you're a nonprofit because you take 10% indigent people if the profit-making hospital is taking 20%. So all these lines and divisions are really breaking down in very interesting ways. And again, a lot of this goes back to this issue, well, if we're going to be subsidizing something we call charity, what do we mean by it? Which is sort of where you started, well, Roger. How can we get this money channeled where we think it is most effective?
Well, and I have a sense that there might be more questions, but I also have to look at my watch, and I see that we've gone over and a little bit and demanded extra time from the panelists. But it was a great end note, I think, that we still are struggling a little bit with what the vision might be, even if there seems to be some consensus that a pluralistic vision might be all right. But I really want to thank the panelists very much for taking the time to be with us today. It was a great panel, and I want to thank all of you for coming as well. It was great to see so many friends and new faces. So thank you.